Accession number 11754, Rule 3.
Captain Ian Smith, Reel 3.
Saying I gave it a quick scratch and it disappeared. I went above cloud and it clearly wasn't there. So descended below the cloud and waited for it to pop out, which it duly did. It was one engine feathered. And I did another quick attack on it from the quarter and shot the other engine out. And it ditched just in the sea just off Skegness. And the crew were all taken prisoner. But as I mentioned this one, because of the peculiar weather circumstances that made it possible. The other amusing thing about it was that when I landed, the group 12 group intelligence officer was standing there, and he said to me, "What was it?" And I said, "It wasn't a Blenheim." He took this literally, didn't realize it was a joke, took this literally. And so he wrote a long article which went all round fighter command about this chap who didn't know what he'd shot down and had said, well, it wasn't a Blenheim. Took the whole thing out of context and made a complete balls of it. That amused me, actually.
Was that in the autumn of 1940?
That was in October 1940.
Can you tell me about the night fighting now, please?
Yes, we had Hurricanes. We painted them black, and there were only one flight commander, I think, had 20-odd hours night flying. The other had about 12. I had about 6 hours night flying. And a sergeant pilot had about the same. And we considered ourselves operational and immediately started doing night patrols, we four. Everyone else in the squadron had less flying time at night. And so our immediate problem was to build up night flying experience. We had a very high accident rate doing this, and we were 100% ineffective as night fighters. Cut a long story short, we were re-equipped with Defiance, and we objected strongly to this because their retrograde step in terms of performance, firepower, tactics. But the aircraft had to be used up because they were useless in the day roll. They were a 1914-18 war concept which had no place in 1940. We objected very strongly to having these Defiance, and as a result, we were allowed to keep our Hurricanes as well, which was unusual. So, but we were told that they wouldn't be replaced as they were used up. So I commanded the Hurricane flight as a pilot officer. We finished up moving to Wittering via various other stations. By the end of December 1940, and where for the first time we had a new CO who knew something about it. We had virtually throughout this period been without a commanding officer. The and under the sort of wise direction of the station commander at Wittering, we started to develop an ability in the night fighter role.
Who was this chap?
Basil Embry. He was Wing Commander Embry when he came there, and he was promoted group captain. Aided by Dick Atchley, who was one of the Atchley brothers, and Jack Adams was our CO, who had come from another night fighter squadron, number 29. And all together, we started to make progress. And the main trouble was that lack of experience, lack of facilities. We had no radar. You could just use your eyes at all. You can intercept dozens of our own aeroplane, but hardly any of them, anyone else would see. Identification was a great problem. For example, I've sat underneath a Wellington's tail, and I could actually see the gunner in his turret, and he didn't see me. And I've been sitting under his tail like this and got in that close before I could identify that it was a Wellington.
By the roundels?
No, by the form of the turret. You couldn't see the roundels. On a really pitch-black night, close to the ground, identification is very difficult. For example, I sat underneath Basil Embry's tail in a bow fighter in a Wittering circuit, unable to identify that it was a bow fighter, and it wasn't till he put his wheels down to land that I could tell that it wasn't a JU-88 in the circuit waiting to do something. It's so difficult to identify. It's pitch black. Unless you've got some background against which to silhouette the thing. Either light or fires or whatever. Very difficult indeed.
Could you hear another aircraft over the sound of your own engine?
No. Couldn't see, no. You see, one of the things that's difficult for anyone to imagine is how many of your senses you lose when you're strapped in a cockpit. You lose all your hearing. You lose a tremendous amount of your vision because it's restricted by so many things. And you become a three-dimensional object instead of a two-dimensional one. You can't stop and think. Everything's continuous movement. And everything there is can kill you. Every single little thing can kill you. So you've got to pay great attention to everything about you. And the greater degree of skill or experience you can develop in handling your machinery and all your equipment and armament, the greater your chances of survival, because then you can give more attention to that side of it and not be looking at your oxygen supply or something else. It's occupying your attention. So it's... And this was one of the problems, I think, in retrospect, I didn't realise at the time, in retrospect, most of us, because of lack of experience in night flying, or lack of ability as well, perhaps, stemming from lack of experience, we were spending too much time with their heads in their cockpit and not enough out. But I don't know how you cure this except by making sure people have the experience. And I think this is perhaps proved, not really proved, but supported by the fact that in the squadron at this time we had a pilot officer, R.P. Stevens, who's an unsung superlative performer, and he shot down more aeroplanes on his own at night than the whole squadron put together. And he was enormously experienced. He had been flying newspapers to Paris before the war in rapides all at night. He had thousands of hours at night flying. And he was a man in his 30s. And he was a solitary character. He was a funny man, peculiar fellow. And but he could see aeroplanes and identify aeroplanes, and no one else could see a thing. And I think this came from his ability, night flying ability, night experience. There was no difference to him being at night and day. And in support of that, one of the reasons, this is a digression, I belong to or a member of a little club called the Anonymous Club, which is a self-electing group of RAF doctors on one side and general duties officers on the other, RAF.
What's the name of the club?
Anonymous. And we meet for dinner once a year, and no speeches, no nonsense, nothing else. We just go and have dinner and talk to each other. And the object of this is to make sure there's very good knowledge and liaison between the medical and the executive side of the RAF, because it's terribly important. Doctors understand the peculiar circumstances that exist, and that people can, if the people have the right sort of spirit or intention or motivation or whatever way one describes it, even if they've only got one eye, one ear, one leg, one tooth, they can be jolly well, the regulations can be bent so that they can go on doing it. And this they do very well indeed. Now, in the course of this, there's the very first flying doctor in the RAF, a man called Ruffell Smith. And at one of the dinners about 10, 15 years ago, I don't go every year, but about 10 or 15 years ago, I said to him, or the question was had he ever been able to identify any common factors present in people who survived the whole war, or who were people like did superlatively well in fighters or any other field or anything like this. Was there any physical characteristic? And he said, yes, two. He said, one is exceptionally long sight that cannot be measured. And the second was a very high tolerance of G-forces. Now, I know that both those things are true in my case, because I've only ever met two people who can see as far as I can. One during the war and one afterwards. And it wasn't till after the war I discovered what I was doing, and I found that I was physically focusing on infinity, and I knew when I was focused on infinity, and I could click my eyes in and out. I could feel the eye muscles move, and so I knew I wasn't focusing on a bit of fly dirt on a windscreen, which is very easy to do at altitude because you have no other reference. And very few people believe this. Quite a lot of neurologists will if they're high enough priced, but few others will. But I firmly believe it is so, and I could do it. And I think this is what Stephen had. He had the ability to focus on infinity at night due to his experience. Whether he knew he had it or not, I don't know. Whereas the rest of us didn't, because we didn't have enough experience, didn't know what we were doing.
Was Stevens a New Zealander?
No, he was English. And there's a biography being written about him by a civil servant who is concerned with the Tangmere Museum. And I've given him what information I had, because there are very few people alive who knew him. But he was quite a remarkable man.
So, when you were doing this work, your squadron was trying to intercept planes raiding the Midland cities, were they?
And London. Hull, the whole of the Midlands, down to London. And we used largely to saturate a target when you knew what the target was. You're usually there after the event. All go off in a heap, different heights, and hope that by chance someone would fly into this lot. And we shot a few things down, but not very many. And then we did a tremendous amount of convoy patrolling. Convoys up and down the east coast from the Humber down were always under attack from torpedo carrying aircraft, and one tended to patrol those at dusk when they're likely to be attacked. We had a few successes there. And that became a contest of who flew lowest, because the lower you flew, the further you could see. And this is over the sea. The sea has different properties to the land, which seems the most obvious thing to say, but when you're flying very low over the sea, it is utterly different to flying very low over the ground. We developed technique of the flying in pairs and up to sections of four into the dark, by the leader going on down, the number two waving him down, until he was leaving a prop wash on the water, so your propeller was literally only a few feet off the tips, a few feet off the water. And then he'd wave you up like this until he had you set the right height, and then he'd come down to your height and sit on you. And if you held that height, you could hold that right into the dark, because when you're at those heights, you get a luminous rim which lasts for quite a long time. On the poorish the visibility, not quite true. You could, even in poorish visibility, I should say, you can. It gives you a horizon to fly on. But if you have to turn and go up, you've lost it. You can't get back again. And so then you're up to the height that you can fly on your instruments, which is a couple of hundred feet on the instruments we had. And but that was quite useful and led to the fact that we could see and sometimes saw enemy aircraft long before they could see us, and so we were able to attack them. We had some success on that. The Hurricanes gradually wore out, and we were replaced with cannon Hurricanes, much to our surprise, so that we could take part in the turbine light project. This was B-26 American Havoc, B-26 bombers with a ton of batteries in them, the big searchlight in the nose, and a Hurricane would formate on the wingtip, and the Havoc had AI and would illuminate the target, and Hurricane would go ahead and shoot it down in the searchlight. It was a very clumsy technique, which was a complete and utter failure.
What light was it called?
Turbine light. T-U-R-B-I-N-E light. L-I-T-E. T-U-R-B. Turbine.
When was that tried out?
In second half of 1941. Spent a long time doing this. I believe some half a dozen of these units, I think, around the country, and I believe one of them shot a German aeroplane down. But in our unit, we didn't. And it was abandoned. Then in April, or by January, February 1942, I was going around borrowing Spitfires and things to fly at night, because the Defiants were hopeless and we only had a few Hurricanes left. And so I'd go to friends of mine who had Spitfire squadrons, they lend me three aeroplanes for tonight. So I'd borrow three aeroplanes for the night, we'd fly those and we'd return them dawn in the morning. And this was all highly unofficial. And the Spitfire was an excellent aeroplane to fly at night because it was relatively stable, a delightful aeroplane. But again, we had no success with it. We agitated to get re-equipped with Mosquitoes, largely through station commander, and this was achieved in April. And so we had AI-equipped Mosquitoes started to arrive in April.
How did you find the Mosquito to fly?
It was excellent, first class, very simple. So long as you flew it as you would fly a tiger moth.
How was that?
Well, you push the pole forward and the nose goes down, and pull it back and the nose comes up. You keep it very simple, nothing sophisticated. No waggling your throttles to keep straight. You know, waggle your rudder, that's what it's for. It had no vices at all. Any problems with the people had with a mosquito were all pilot-induced or training-induced or misconception. For example, Bomber Command came to me and said, how do you manage to have so few accidents? And I said, well, I always have the ailerons trimmed with maximum droop so they're as light as a feather. You can roll a mosquito with finger and thumb, you know. They went the opposite way and had them stiffened up and with maximum whatnot so that people couldn't move them, you know, because people were finishing up upside down and all sorts of things at night. This was sort of complete lack of analytical ability on their part in deciding where the faults lay. It lay in other directions, not the machine, blaming the machine for faults that occurred elsewhere. Anyhow, we were the only person who had twin-engine experience in 151 Squadron was one flight commander. And while I'd flown one or two twin-engine aeroplanes, just incidentally, I had no twin-engine experience. But we just went and flew them. You know, they're aeroplanes. They all behave the same way and fly it, you know. Simple. Anyhow, we didn't have a dual aeroplane, and all I did was to sit alongside each pilot. I did them all, and sit there in the navigator's seat and say, now, this is what you do. So you fly it, fly it. These are the speeds. And they flew it. Away we went. We had, for a year, I remember the figures, we had one accident in 10,000 hours, which was remarkable. And that was one that broke up in the air. We never knew why. We think a chap must have been doing something silly. There were no ground accidents of any sort. They're very unreliable to start with because the glues weren't good. Gluing techniques weren't good. I'm not sure which. Sometimes